Yet, for reasons we don't completely understand, distinct species do exist in nature, and they exhibit a certain genetic integrity. Sex between them, when it does occur, doesn't produce fertile offspring. Nature presumably has some reason for erecting these walls, even if they are permeable on occasion. Perhaps, as some biologists believe, the purpose of keeping species separate is to put barriers in the path of pathogens, to contain their damage so that a single germ can't wipe out life on Earth at a stroke. The deliberate introduction into a plant of genes transported not only across species, but across whole phyla, means that the wall of that plant's essential identity, its irreducible wildness, you might say, has been breached, not by a virus, as sometimes happens in nature, but by humans wielding powerful new tools. For the first time, the genome itself is being domesticated, brought under the roof of human culture. This made the potato I was growing slightly different from the other plants in this book, all of which had been both the subjects and the objects of domestication. While the other plants co-evolved in a kind of conversational give-and-take with people, the new-leaf potato has really only taken, only listened. It may or may not profit from the gift of its new genes. We can't yet say. What we can say, though, is that this potato is not the hero of its own story in quite the same way the apple has been. It didn't come up with this BT scheme all on its evolutionary own. No. The heroes of the new leaf story are scientists working for Monsanto. Certainly the scientists in the lab coats have something in common with the fellow in the coffee sack. Both work or worked at disseminating plant genes around the world. Yet although Johnny Appleseed and the brewers of beer and makers of cheese, the high-tech pot growers and all the other biotechnologists manipulated, selected, forced, cloned, and otherwise altered the species they worked with, the species themselves never lost their evolutionary say in the matter, never became solely the objects of our desires. Now the once irreducible wildness of these plants has been reduced. Whether this is a good or bad thing for the plants, or for us, it is unquestionably a new thing. What is perhaps most striking about the new leaves coming up in my garden is the added human intelligence that the insertion of the Bacillus thuringiensis gene represents. In the past, that intelligence resided outside the plant, in the minds of the organic farmers and gardeners, myself included, who used BT, commonly in the form of a spray, to manipulate the ecological relationship between certain insects and a certain bacterium in order to foil those insects. The irony about the new BT crops, a similar gene has been inserted into corn plants, is that the cultural information they encode happens to be knowledge that's always resided in the heads of the very sorts of people, that is, organic growers, who most distrust high technology. Most of the other biotech crops, such as the ones Monsanto has engineered to withstand Roundup, the company's patented herbicide, encode a very different, more industrial sort of intelligence. One way to look at genetic engineering is that it allows a larger portion of human culture and intelligence to be incorporated into the plants themselves. From this perspective, my new leaves are just plain smarter than the rest of my potatoes. The others will depend on my knowledge and experience when the Colorado potato beetles strike. The new leaves, already knowing what I know about bugs and BT, will take care of themselves. So while my genetically engineered plants might at first seem like alien beings, that's not quite right. They're more like us than other plants, because there's more of us in them. Ireland, 1588. Like an alien species introduced into an established ecosystem, the potato had trouble finding a foothold when it first arrived in Europe toward the end of the 16th century, probably as an afterthought in the hold of a Spanish ship. The problem was not with the European soil or climate, which would prove very much to the potato's liking, in the north anyway, but with the European mind. Even after people recognize that this peculiar new plant could produce more food on less land than any other crop, most of European culture remained inhospitable to the potato. Why? Europeans hadn't eaten tubers before. The potato was a member of the nightshade family, along with the equally disreputable tomato. Potatoes were thought to cause leprosy and immorality. Potatoes were mentioned nowhere in the Bible. Potatoes came from America, where they were the staple of an uncivilized and conquered race. The justifications given for refusing to eat potatoes were many and diverse, but in the end, most of them came down to this. The new plant, and in this respect it was quite unlike my new leaf, seemed to contain in its being too little of human culture and rather too much unreconstructed nature. Oh, but what about Ireland? Ireland was the exception that proved the rule. Indeed, the exception that largely wrote the rule, since that country's extraordinary relationship to the potato consolidated its dubious identity in the English mind. Ireland embraced the potato very soon after its introduction, a fateful event sometimes credited to Sir Walter Raleigh, sometimes to the shipwreck of a Spanish galleon off the Irish coast in 1588. As it happened, the cultural, political, and biological environment of Ireland could not have better suited the new plant. Cereal grains grow poorly on the island, wheat hardly at all, and in the 17th century, Cromwell's roundheads seized what little arable land there was for English landowners, forcing the Irish peasantry to eke out a subsistence from soil so rain-soaked and stingy that virtually nothing would grow in it. The potato, miraculously, would, managing to extract prodigious amounts of food from the very land the colonial English had given up on. And so, by the end of the 17th century, the plant had made a beachhead in the Old World. Within two centuries, it would overrun Northern Europe, in the process substantially remaking its new habitat. The Irish discovered that a few acres of marginal land could produce enough potatoes to feed a large family and its livestock. The Irish also found they could grow these potatoes with a bare minimum of labor or tools, in something called a lazy bed. The spuds were simply laid out in a rectangle on the ground. Then with a spade, the farmer would dig a drainage trench on either side of his potato bed, covering the tubers with whatever soil, sod, or peat came out of the trench. No plowed earth, no rows, and certainly no agricultural sublime, a damnable defect in English eyes. Potato growing looked nothing like agriculture, provided none of the Apollonian satisfactions of an orderly field of grain, no martial ranks of golden wheat ripening in the sun. Wheat pointed up to the sun and civilization. The potato pointed down. Potatoes were thonic, forming their undifferentiated brown tubers unseen beneath the ground, throwing a slovenly flop of vines above. The Irish were too hungry to worry about agricultural aesthetics. The potato might not have presented a picture of order or control in the field, yet it gave the Irish a welcome measure of control over their lives. Now they could feed themselves off the economic grid ruled by the English and not have to worry so much about the price of bread or the going wage. For the Irish had discovered that a diet of potatoes supplemented with cow's milk was nutritionally complete. In addition to energy in the form of carbohydrates, potatoes supplied considerable amounts of protein and vitamins B and C. The spud would eventually put an end to scurvy in Europe. All that was missing was vitamin A, and that a bit of milk could make up. So it turns out that mashed potatoes are not only the ultimate comfort food, but all a body really needs. And as easy as they were to grow, potatoes were even easier to prepare. Dig, heat, by either boiling them in a pot or simply dropping them into a fire, and eat. Eventually, the potato's undeniable advantages over grain would convert all of Northern Europe, but outside Ireland, the process was never anything less than a struggle. In Germany, Frederick the Great had to force peasants to plant potatoes. So did Catherine the Great in Russia. Louis XVI took a subtler tack, reasoning that if he could just lend the humble spud a measure of royal prestige, peasants would experiment with it and discover its virtues. So Marie Antoinette took to wearing potato flowers in her hair, and Louis hatched an ingenious promotional scheme. He ordered a field of potatoes planted on the royal grounds and then posted his most elite guard to protect the crop during the day. He sent the guards home at midnight, however, and in due course the local peasants, suddenly convinced of the crop's value, made off in the night with the royal tubers. In time, all three nations would grow powerful on potatoes, which put an end to malnutrition and periodic famine in northern Europe and allowed the land to support a much larger population than it ever could have planted in grain. Since fewer hands were needed to farm it, the potato also allowed the countryside to feed northern Europe's growing and industrializing cities. Europe's center of political gravity had always been anchored firmly in the hot, sunny south, where wheat grew reliably. Without the potato, the balance of European power might never have tilted north. The last redoubt of anti-potato prejudice was in England, and there it was not confined to a hidebound or superstitious peasantry. Well into the 19th century, a significant portion of elite opinion in London regarded the potato as nothing more or less than a threat to civilization. Proof? All one had to do was point in the direction of Ireland. England, 1794. The wheat harvest in the British Isles failed in 1794, sending the price of white bread beyond the reach of England's poor. Food riots broke out, and with them a great debate over the potato that would rage on and off for half a century. The potato debate is recounted in Redcliffe Salomon's definitive 1949 volume, The History and Social Influence of the Potato, and its rhetoric is brilliantly dissected in The Potato in the Materialist Imagination, an essay by the literary critic Catherine Gallagher. Engaging the energies of the country's leading journalists, agronomists, and political economists, the potato debate brought to the surface predictable English anxieties about class conflict and the Irish problem. But it also threw into sharp relief people's deepest feelings about their food plants and the ways they root us, for better and worse, in nature. Do we control these plants, or do they control us? The debate was kicked off by the potato's advocates, who argued that introducing a second staple would be a boon to England, a way to feed the poor when bread was dear and keep wages, which tended to track the price of bread, from rising. Arthur Young, a respected agronomist, had traveled to Ireland and returned convinced that the potato was a root of plenty that could protect England's poor from hunger and give farmers more control over their circumstances at a time when the enclosure movement was undermining their traditional way of life. The radical journalist William Cobbett also traveled to Ireland, yet he returned with a very different picture of the potato eaters. Whereas Young had seen self-reliance in the Irishman's potato patch, Cobbett saw only abject subsistence and dependence. Cobbett argued that while it was true that the potato fed the Irish, it also impoverished them by driving up the country's population from 3 million to 8 million in less than a century, and driving down its wages. The prolific potato allowed young Irishmen to marry earlier and support a larger family. As the labor supply increased, wages fell. The bounty of the potato was its curse. In his articles, Cobbett depicted this damned root as a kind of gravitational force, pulling the Irishman out of civilization and back down into the earth, gradually muddying the distinctions between man and beast, even man and root. This is how he described the potato eater's mud hut. No windows at all. The floor nothing but the bare earth. No chimney but a hole at one end, surrounded by a few stones. In Cobbett's grim imagery, the Irish had themselves moved underground, joining their tubers in the mud. Once cooked, the potatoes are taken up and turned into a great dish, Cobbett wrote. The families squat round this basket and take out the potatoes with their hands. The pig stands and is helped by someone, and sometimes he eats out of the pot. He goes in and out and about the hole like one of the family. The potato had single-handedly unraveled civilization, putting nature back in control of man. Bread root was what the English sometimes called the potato, and the symbolic contrast between the two foods loomed large in the debate, never to the Spud's advantage. Catherine Gallagher points out that the English usually depicted the potato as mere food, primitive, unreconstructed, and lacking in any cultural resonance. In time, that lack would itself become precisely the potato's cultural resonance. The potato came to signify the end of food being anything more than food, animal fuel. Bread, on the other hand, was as leavened with meaning as it was with air. Like the potato, wheat begins in nature, but it is then transformed by culture. While the potato is simply thrown into a pot or fire, wheat must be harvested, threshed, milled, mixed, kneaded, shaped, baked, and then, in a final miracle of transubstantiation, the doughy lump of formless matter rises to become bread. This elaborate process, with its division of labor and suggestion of transcendence, symbolized civilization's mastery of raw nature. A mere food thus became the substance of human and even spiritual communion, for there was also the old identification of bread with the body of Christ. If the lumpish potato was base matter, bread in the Christian mind was its very opposite. Antimatter, even spirit. The political economists also weighed in on the potato debate, and though they framed their arguments in somewhat more scientific terms, their rhetoric too betrays deep anxieties about nature's threat to civilization's control. Malthusian logic started from the premise that people are driven by the desires for food and sex. Only the threat of starvation keeps the population from exploding. The danger of the potato, Malthus believed, was that it removed the economic constraints that ordinarily kept the population in check. This, in a nutshell, was Ireland's problem. The indolent and turbulent habits of the lower Irish can never be corrected while the potato system enables them to increase so much beyond the regular demand for labor. In the same way that the potato exempts the potato eater from the civilizing processes of bread making, it also exempts him from the discipline of the economy. Political economists like Adam Smith and David Ricardo regarded the market as a sensitive mechanism for adjusting the size of the population to the demand for labor, and the price of bread was that mechanism's regulator. When the price of wheat rose, people had to curb both of their animal appetites and so produced fewer babies. The problem with the potato system is that under it, the homo economicus, who adjusts his behavior to the algebra of need, is replaced by a far less rational actor, homo appetitus, as Gallagher calls him. If economic man operated under the coolly rational sign of Apollo, appetite man was enthralled to earthy, fecund, amoral Dionysus. Since the Irishman grew and ate his own potatoes, and since his potatoes, unlike wheat flour, could not easily be stored or traded, they never became commodities and were therefore, like him, subject to no authority but nature's own. In the eyes of the political economists, capitalist exchange was a lot like baking, since it represented a way of civilizing anarchic nature. The anarchic nature, that is, of both plants and people. Without the discipline of commodity markets, man is thrown back on his instincts. Unlimited food and sex leading inexorably to overpopulation and misery. David Ricardo was convinced that the potato was both the cause and symbol of this regression, this surrender of control to nature. As long as humans need to eat, we can never completely insulate ourselves from the vicissitudes of nature. The best we can do, Ricardo believed, was to rely on a staple that, like wheat, can be stored against storms and droughts and readily converted into money to buy other foods. The potato offered no such security. By refusing to transcend its own nature and become a commodity, the potato threatened, in Gallagher's words, to wipe out the progress an advanced economy has made in liberating humankind from dependence on shifty nature. About this much, at least, history would prove the political economists terribly correct. The control with which the potato appeared to have blessed the Irish would turn out to be a cruel illusion. Dependence on the potato had, in fact, made the Irish exquisitely vulnerable, not to the vicissitudes of the economy so much as to those of nature. This they would abruptly discover late in the summer of 1845, when Phytophthora infestans arrived in Europe, probably on a ship from America. Within weeks, the spores of this savage fungus, borne on the wind, overspread the continent, dooming potatoes and potato eaters alike. St. Louis, June 23rd. While my new leaves were bushing up nicely during a spell of hot early summer weather, I traveled to Monsanto's headquarters in St. Louis, where the ancient, noble dream of control of nature is in full and extravagant flower. If the place to go to understand the relationship of people and potato was a mountainside farm in South America in 1532, or a lazy bed near Dublin in 1845, today it is just as surely a research greenhouse on a corporate campus outside St. Louis. My new leaves are clones of plants that were first engineered more than a decade ago in a long, low-slung brick building on the bank of the Missouri that would look like any other corporate complex, if not for its stunning roofline. What appear from a distance to be shimmering crenellations of glass turn out to be the 26 greenhouses that crown the building in a dramatic sequence of triangular peaks. The first generation of genetically altered plants, of which the new leaf potato is one, has been grown under this roof in these greenhouses since 1984. Especially in the early days of biotechnology, no one knew for sure if it was safe to grow these plants outdoors in nature. Today, this research and development facility is one of a small handful of such places. Monsanto has only two or three competitors in the world, where the world's crop plants are being redesigned. Dave Stark, one of Monsanto's senior potato people, escorted me through the clean rooms where potatoes are genetically engineered. He explained that there are two ways of splicing foreign genes into a plant: by infecting it with agrobacterium, a pathogen whose modus operandi is to break into a plant cell's nucleus and replace its DNA with some of its own, or by shooting it with a gene gun. For reasons not yet understood, the agrobacterium method seems to work best on broadleaf species such as the potato, the gene gun better on grasses such as corn and wheat. The gene gun is a strangely high-low piece of technology, but the main thing you need to know about it is that the gun here is not a metaphor. A .22 caliber shell is used to fire stainless steel projectiles dipped in a DNA solution at the stem or leaf of the target plant. If all goes well, some of the DNA will pierce the wall of some of the cell's nuclei and elbow its way into the double helix, a bully breaking into a line dance. If the new DNA happens to land in the right place, and no one yet knows what or where that place is, the plant grown from that cell will express the new gene. That's it? That's it. Apart from its slightly more debonair means of entry, the agrobacterium works in much the same way. In the clean rooms, where the air pressure is kept artificially high to prevent errant microbes from wandering in, technicians sit at lab benches before petri dishes in which fingernail-sized sections of potato stem have been placed in a clear nutrient jelly. Into this medium, they squirt a solution of agrobacteria, which have already had their genes swapped with the ones Monsanto wants to insert. Specific enzymes can be used to cut and paste precise sequences of DNA. In addition to the BT gene being spliced, a marker gene is also included. Typically, this is a gene conferring resistance to a specific antibiotic. This way, the technicians can later flood the dish with the antibiotic to see which cells have taken up the new DNA. Any that haven't simply die. The marker gene can also serve as a kind of DNA fingerprint, allowing Monsanto to identify its plants and their descendants long after they've left the lab. By performing a simple test on any potato leaf in my garden, a Monsanto agent can prove whether or not the plant is the company's intellectual property. I realize that, whatever else it is, genetic engineering is also a powerful technique for transforming plants into private property, by giving every one of them what amounts to its own universal product code. After several hours, the surviving slips of potato stem begin to put down roots. A few days later, these plantlets are moved upstairs to the potato greenhouse on the roof. Here I met Glenda Debrecht, a cheerful staff horticulturist, who invited me to don latex gloves and help her transplant pinky-sized plantlets from their petri dishes to small pots filled with customized soil. After the abstractions of the laboratory, I felt back on quasi-familiar ground, in a greenhouse, handling actual plants. The whole operation, from petri dish to transplant to greenhouse, is performed thousands of times, Glenda explained as we worked across a wheeled potting bench from each other, largely because there is so much uncertainty about the outcome, even after the DNA is accepted. If the new DNA winds up in the wrong place in the genome, for example, the new gene won't be expressed, or it will be expressed only poorly. In nature, that is, in sexual reproduction, genes move not one by one, but in the company of associated genes that regulate their expression, turning them on and off. The transfer of genetic material is also much more orderly in sex, the process somehow ensuring that every gene ends up in its proper neighborhood and doesn't trip over other genes in the process, inadvertently affecting their function. Genetic instability is the catch-all term used to describe the various unexpected effects that misplaced or unregulated foreign genes can have on their new environment. These can range from the subtle and invisible, a particular protein is over or underexpressed in the new plant, say, to the manifestly outlandish. Glenda sees a great many freaky potato plants. Stark told me that the gene transfer takes anywhere between 10% and 90% of the time, an eyebrow-raising statistic. For some unknown reason, genetic instability, the process produces a great deal of variability, even though it begins with a single, known, cloned strain of potato. So we grow out thousands of different plants, Glenda explained, and then look for the best. The result is often a potato that is superior in ways the presence of the new gene can't explain. This would certainly explain the vigor of my new leaves. I was struck by the uncertainty surrounding the process, how this technology is at the same time both astoundingly sophisticated, yet still a shot in the genetic dark. Throw a bunch of DNA against the wall and see what sticks. Do this enough times, and you're bound to get what you're looking for. Transplanting potatoes with Glenda also made me realize that it may be impossible ever to conclude once and for all that this technology is intrinsically sound or dangerous. For every new genetically engineered plant is a unique event in nature, bringing its own set of genetic contingencies. This means that the reliability or safety of one genetically modified plant doesn't necessarily guarantee the reliability or safety of the next. There's still a lot we don't understand about gene expression, Stark acknowledged. A great many factors, including the environment, influence whether, and to what extent, an introduced gene will do what it's supposed to do. In one early experiment, scientists succeeded in splicing a gene for redness into petunias. In the field, everything went according to plan, until the temperature hit 90 degrees and an entire planting of red petunias suddenly and inexplicably turned white. Wouldn't this sort of thing, these Dionysian jokers rearing up in the ordered Apollonian fields, rattle one's faith in genetic determinism a little? It's obviously not quite as simple as putting a software program into a computer. July 1st. When I got home from St. Louis, my potato crop was thriving. It was time to hill up the plants, so with a hoe, I pulled the rich soil from the lips of the trenches down around the stems to protect the developing tubers from the light. I also dressed the plants with a few shovelfuls of old cow manure. Potatoes seemed to love the stuff. The best, sweetest potatoes I ever tasted were ones that, as a teenager, I helped a neighbor dig out of the pile of pure horse manure he'd planted them in. I sometimes think it must have been this dazzling example of alchemy that sold me, not just on potato growing, but on gardening as a quasi-magical, quasi-sacramental thing to do. My new leaves were big as shrubs now, and crowned with slender flower stalks. Potato flowers are actually quite pretty, at least by the standards of a vegetable. Five-petaled lavender stars with yellow centers that give off a faint rose-like perfume. One sultry afternoon, I watched the bumblebees making their rounds of my potato blossoms, thoughtlessly chalking themselves with yellow pollen grains before lumbering off to appointments with other blossoms, other species. Uncertainty is the theme that unifies most of the questions now being raised about agricultural biotechnology by environmentalists and scientists. By planting millions of acres of genetically altered plants, we are introducing something novel into the environment and the food chain, the consequences of which are not completely understood. Several of these uncertainties have to do with the fate of the grains of pollen these bumblebees are carting off from my potatoes. For one thing, that pollen, like every other part of the plant, contains Bt toxin. The toxin, which is produced by a bacterium that occurs naturally in the soil, is generally thought to be safe for humans, yet the Bt in genetically modified crops is behaving a little differently from the ordinary Bt that farmers have been spraying on their crops for years. Instead of quickly breaking down in nature as it usually does, genetically modified Bt toxin seems to be building up in the soil. This may be insignificant. We don't know. We don't really know what Bt is doing in soil in the first place. We also don't know what effect all this new Bt in the environment may have on the insects we don't want to kill, though there are reasons to be concerned. In laboratory experiments, scientists have found that the pollen from Bt corn is lethal to monarch butterflies. Monarchs don't eat corn pollen, but they do eat, exclusively, the leaves of milkweed, Asclepias syriaca, a weed that is common in American cornfields. When monarch caterpillars eat milkweed leaves dusted with Bt corn pollen, they sicken and die. Will this happen in the field? And how serious will the problem be if it does? We don't know. What is remarkable is that someone thought to ask the question in the first place. As we learned during the glory days of the chemical paradigm, the ecological effects of changes to the environment often show up where we least expect to find them. DDT in its time was thoroughly tested and found to be safe and effective. Until it was discovered that this unusually long-lived chemical travels through the food chain and happens to thin out the shells of birds' eggs. The question that led scientists to this discovery wasn't even a question about DDT. It was a question about birds. Why is the world's population of raptors suddenly collapsing? DDT was the answer. Hoping not to encounter that sort of surprise again, scientists are busy trying to imagine the sorts of questions to which Bt or Roundup Ready crops might someday prove to be the unexpected answer. One of those questions has to do with gene flow. What might happen to the Bt genes in the pollen my bumblebees are moving from blossom to blossom around my garden? Through cross-pollination, those genes can wind up in other plants, possibly conferring a new evolutionary advantage on that species. Most domesticated plants do poorly in the wild. The traits we breed them for, fruit that ripens all at once, say, often render them less fit for life in the wild. But biotech plants have been given traits, such as insect or pesticide resistance, that render them more fit in nature. Gene flow ordinarily occurs only between closely related species, and since the potato evolved in South America, the chances are slim that my Bt genes will escape into the wilds of Connecticut to spawn some kind of superweed. That's Monsanto's contention, and there's no reason to doubt it. But it is interesting to note that while genetic engineering depends for its power on the ability to break down the genetic walls between species and even phyla in order to freely move genes among them, the environmental safety of the technology depends on precisely the opposite phenomenon, on the integrity of species in nature and their tendency to reject alien genetic material. Yet what will happen if Peruvian farmers plant BT potatoes? Or if I plant a biotech crop that does have local relatives? Scientists have already proved that the Roundup Ready gene can migrate in a single generation from a field of rapeseed oil plants to a related weed in the mustard family, which then exhibits tolerance to the herbicide. The same has happened with genetically modified beets. This came as no great surprise. What did is the discovery, in one experiment, that transgenes migrate more readily than ordinary ones. No one knows why, but these well-traveled genes may prove to be especially jumpy. Jumping genes and superweeds point to a new kind of environmental problem, biological pollution, which some environmentalists believe will be the unhappy legacy of agriculture's shift from a chemical to a biological paradigm. We are already familiar with one form of biological pollution. Invasive exotic species such as kudzu, zebra mussels, and Dutch elm disease. Harmful as chemical pollution can be, it eventually disperses and fades. But biological pollution is self-replicating. Think of it as the difference between an oil spill and a disease. Once a transgene introduces a new weed or a resistant pest into the environment, it can't very well be cleaned up. It will already have become part of nature. In the case of the new leaf potato, the most likely form of biological pollution is the evolution of insects resistant to BT, a development that would ruin one of the safest insecticides we have and do great harm to the organic farmers who depend on it. What the emergence of BT resistance might mean for the environment is harder to say. We have lots of experience with pests developing resistance to man-made pesticides, but what will happen if one of nature's own pest controls loses its effectiveness? The phenomenon of insect resistance offers an object lesson in the difficulties of controlling nature, as well as the problem with using a linear machine metaphor to deal with a process as complex and nonlinear as evolution. For this is a case where the more thorough our control of nature is, the sooner natural selection will overthrow it. According to the theory, which is based on classical Darwinism, the new BT crops add so much BT toxin to the environment on such a continuous basis that the target pests will evolve resistance to it. The only real question is how long this will take to happen. Before now, resistance hasn't been a worry because conventional BT sprays break down quickly in sunlight and farmers spray only when confronted with a serious infestation. Resistance is essentially a form of coevolution that occurs when a given population is threatened with extinction. That pressure quickly selects for whatever chance mutation will allow the species to change and survive. Through natural selection, then, one species' attempt at total control can engender its own nemesis. I was surprised to learn that the specter of BT resistance has forced Monsanto to temporarily lay aside its mechanistic habits of thought and approach the problem more like, well, a Darwinian. Working with government regulators, the company has developed a resistance management plan to postpone BT resistance. Farmers who plant BT crops must leave a certain portion of their land planted in non-BT crops in order to create refuges for the targeted bugs. The goal is to prevent the first BT-resistant Colorado potato beetle from mating with a second resistant bug, and thereby launching a new race of superbugs. The theory is that when that first BT-resistant insect does show up, it can be induced to mate with a susceptible bug living on the refuge side of the tracks, thereby diluting the new gene for resistance. The plan implicitly acknowledges that if this new control of nature is to last, a certain amount of no control or wildness will have to be deliberately cultivated. The thinking may be sound, but an awful lot has to go right for Mr. Wrong to meet Miss Right. No one can be sure how big the refuges have to be, where they should be located, and whether farmers will cooperate. Creating safe havens for your most destructive pests is counterintuitive after all. Not to mention the bugs. Monsanto executives voice confidence that the plan will work, though their definition of success will come as small comfort to organic farmers. The company's scientists say that if all goes well, resistance can be postponed for 30 years. After that? Dave Yell, the company's director of regulatory affairs, told me over lunch in St. Louis that BT resistance shouldn't overly concern us, since there are 1,000 other BTs out there. That is, other proteins with insecticidal properties. We can handle this problem with new products. The critics don't know what we have in the pipeline. This is, of course, how chemical companies have always handled the problem of pest resistance, by simply introducing a new and improved pesticide every few years. With any luck, the effectiveness of the last one will expire around the same time its patent does. Behind the bland corporate assurances, though, stands a fairly startling admission. Monsanto is acknowledging that, in the case of BT, it plans on simply using up not just another patented synthetic chemical, but a natural resource, one that, if it belongs to anyone, belongs to everyone. The true cost of this technology is being charged to the future. No new paradigm there. Today's gain in control over nature will be paid for by tomorrow's new disorder, which in turn will become simply a fresh problem for science to solve. We can cross that bridge when we come to it. Of course, it was precisely this attitude toward the future that encouraged us to build nuclear power plants before anybody had figured out what to do with the waste. A bridge we now badly need to cross, but find we still don't have any idea how to. Dave Yell is a disarmingly candid man, and before we finished our lunch, he uttered two words that I never thought I'd hear from the lips of a corporate executive, except perhaps in a bad movie. I'd assumed these two words had been scrupulously expunged from the corporate vocabulary many years ago, during a previous paradigm long since discredited, but Dave Yell proved me wrong. Trust us. July 7th. My Colorado potato beetle vigil came to an end the first week of July, shortly before I planned to fly to Idaho to visit potato growers. I found a small platoon of larvae, soft brown dabs wearing what looked like miniature backpacks, munching with impunity on the leaves of my ordinary potato plants. I couldn't find a single one of the bugs on my new leaves, however, either alive or dead. Glenda DeBrecht, the Monsanto horticulturist, had prepared me for this. Predator insects were probably feasting on the bugs the new leaves had killed. I kept looking for them, though, and eventually I spied a single mature beetle sitting on a new leaf. When I reached to pick it up, the beetle fell drunkenly to the ground. It had been sickened by the plant and would shortly be dead. My new leaves were working. I have to admit to a certain thrill, a triumphal feeling that any gardener who has battled pests will understand. The typical gardener is not in the least bit romantic about the wildlife that assaults his plants, not the bugs or the woodchucks or the deer, and in his heart of hearts he believes that all is fair in war, even if organic principles, sort of like the Geneva Convention, do sometimes prevent him from heeding his heart's desire. But make no mistake, this is a desire whose fantasies feature rifles, explosives, and chemicals of unspeakable toxicity. So to watch a potato plant single-handedly vanquish a potato beetle is, at least from this perspective, a thing of beauty. An ingenious new twist on the agricultural sublime. Idaho, July 8th. The agricultural sublime was very much on my mind during my flight west, especially as we crossed into Idaho. From 30,000 feet, the perfect green circles formed by the irrigation pivots of the dryland farmer are breathtaking. In places, the Idaho landscape becomes an endless grid of verdant coins pressed into the scrubby brown desert, squared circles as far as the eye can see. It's an image not only of human order, like the rows of corn back home, but also, in a landscape as inhospitable as the American West, of human habitation hard won. I would soon discover, however, that this austere beauty is harder to see on the ground. No one can make a better case for a biotech crop than a potato farmer, which is why Monsanto was eager for me to come out to Idaho to meet a few of their customers. From where a typical American potato grower stands, the new leaf looks very much like a godsend. That's because the typical potato grower stands in the middle of a bright green circle of plants that have been doused with so much pesticide that their leaves wear a dull white chemical bloom and the soil they're rooted in is a lifeless gray powder. Farmers call this a clean field, since ideally it has been cleansed of all weeds and insects and disease. Of all life, that is, with the sole exception of the potato plant. A clean field represents a triumph of human control, but it is a triumph that even many farmers have come to doubt. To such a farmer, a new kind of potato that promises to eliminate the need for even a single spraying of chemicals is, very simply, an economic and environmental and perhaps even psychological boon. Danny Forsyth laid out the chemistry and economics of modern potato growing for me one sweltering morning at the sleepy but well-air-conditioned coffee shop in Jerome, Idaho, a one-street, one-coffee-shop town about 100 miles east of Boise on the interstate. Forsyth is a slight, blue-eyed man in his early 60s with a small, unexpected gray ponytail, a somewhat nervous manner, and a passing resemblance to Don Knotts. He farms 3,000 acres of potatoes, corn, and wheat here in the Magic Valley, much of it on land inherited from his father. When he talks about agricultural chemicals, he sounds like a man desperate to kick a bad habit. "None of us would use them if we had any choice," he said. He believes Monsanto is offering him that choice. I asked Forsyth to walk me through a season's regimen, the state of the art in the control of a potato field. Typically, it begins early in the spring with a soil fumigant. To control nematodes and certain diseases in the soil, potato farmers douse their fields before planting with a chemical toxic enough to kill every trace of microbial life in the soil. Next, Forsyth puts down an herbicide, Lexan, Sencor, or Eptem, to clean his fields of all weeds. Then, at planting, a systemic insecticide, such as Thimet, is applied to the soil. This will be absorbed by the young seedlings and kill any insect that eats their leaves for several weeks. When the potato seedlings are 6 inches tall, a second herbicide is sprayed on the field to control weeds. Dryland farmers like Forsyth farm in the vast circles I'd seen from the sky. Each circle, defined by the radius of the irrigation pivot, typically covers an area of 135 acres. Pesticides and fertilizer are simply added to the irrigation system, which on Forsyth's farm draws water from, and returns it to, the nearby Snake River. Along with their ration of water, Forsyth's potatoes receive 10 weekly sprayings of chemical fertilizer. Just before the rows close, when the leaves of one row of plants meet those of the next, he begins spraying Bravo, a fungicide, to control late blight, the same fungus that caused the Irish potato famine and is once again today the potato grower's most worrisome threat. A single spore can infect a field overnight, Forsyth said, turning the tubers into a rotting mush. Beginning this month, Forsyth will hire a crop duster to spray for aphids at 14-day intervals. The aphids are harmless in themselves, but they transmit the leaf roll virus, which causes net necrosis in russet burbanks, a brown spotting of the potato's flesh that will cause a processor to reject a whole crop. Despite all his efforts to control it, this happened to Forsyth just last year. Net necrosis is a purely cosmetic defect, yet because McDonald's believes, with good reason, that we don't like to see brown spots in our French fries, farmers like Danny Forsyth must spray their fields with some of the most toxic chemicals now in use, including an organophosphate called Monitor. Monitor is a deadly chemical, Forsyth told me. It is known to damage the human nervous system. I won't go into a field for 4 or 5 days after it's been sprayed, not even to fix a broken pivot. That is, Forsyth would sooner lose a whole circle to drought than expose himself or an employee to this poison. Leaving aside the health and environmental costs, the economic cost of all this control is daunting. A potato farmer in Idaho spends roughly $1,950 an acre, mainly on chemicals, electricity, and water, to grow a crop that, in a good year, will earn him maybe $2,000. That's how much a French fry processor will pay for the 20 tons of potatoes a single Idaho acre can yield. It's not hard to see why a farmer like Forsyth, struggling against such tight margins and heartsick over chemicals, would leap at a new leaf. "The new leaf means I can skip a couple of sprayings," Forsyth said. "I save money and I sleep better. It also happens to be a nice-looking spud." Before driving out to have a look at his fields, Forsyth and I got onto the subject of organic agriculture, about which he had the usual things to say. "That's all fine on a small scale, but they don't have to feed the world." And a few things I never expected to hear from a conventional farmer. "I like to eat organic food, and in fact I grow a lot of it at the house. The vegetables we buy at the market we just wash and wash and wash. I'm not sure I should be saying this, but I always plant a small area of potatoes without any chemicals. By the end of the season, my field potatoes are fine to eat, but any potatoes I pulled today are probably still full of systemics. I don't eat them." Danny Forsyth's words came back to me a few hours later, during lunch at the home of another Magic Valley farmer. Steve Young is a progressive, prosperous potato grower, a player in the admiring words of my Monsanto escort. A big, bluff man in his 40s, Young farms 10,000 acres. Even after passing the entrance to his farm, you have to drive for miles before arriving at his house. He showed me the computers that automatically regulate his 85 circles of spuds. Each circle on the screen stands for and controls one circle in the field. Without so much as stepping outside, Young can water his fields or spray them with pesticide. Young seemed very much the master of his fate as well as his fields, the picture of a thoroughly modern farmer. He's built his own potato storage facility, a controlled atmosphere shed big as a football field, housing a mountain of russet Burbanks 30 feet tall, and he owns a share in a local chemical distributorship. Compared to Danny Forsyth, a man who clearly feels himself very much at the mercy of the chemicals, the aphids, and the potato processors, Young gives the impression, at least, of a man in complete control. Mrs. Young had prepared a lavish feast for us, and after Dave, their 18-year-old, said grace, adding a special prayer for me, the Youngs are devout Mormons, she passed around a big bowl of potato salad. As I helped myself, my Monsanto escort asked her what was in the salad, flashing me a smile that suggested she might already know. "It's a combination of new leaves and some of our regular russets," Mrs. Young said, positively beaming. "Dug this very morning." As I slowly chewed my potato salad, I considered which ingredient was more likely to be hazardous to my health, the new leaves or the russets a la Thimmet. The answer, I decided, is almost certainly potato number 2. There might be unknowns about the new leaves, but the russets I knew to be full of poison. And the answer says something important about genetically engineered plants I wasn't ready to hear, at least not before coming out to Idaho. After I talked to farmers like Danny Forsyth and Steve Young while walking fields made sterile by a drenching, season-long rain of chemicals, Monsanto's new leaves began to look like a blessing. Set against current practices, genetically modified potatoes represent a more sustainable way of growing food. The problem is, that isn't saying much. After my lunch with the Youngs, I shook off my escort long enough to pay a visit to a nearby organic potato grower. I knew enough not to take someone from Monsanto to visit an organic farm. If there's a source of evil in agriculture, an organic farmer from Maine had told me, its name is Monsanto. Mike Heath is a rugged, lined, laconic man in his mid-50s. Like most of the organic farmers I've ever met, he looks as though he spends a lot more time outdoors than a conventional farmer, and he probably does. Chemicals are, among other things, labor-saving devices. While we drove around his 500 acres in a battered old pickup truck, I asked him what he thought about genetic engineering. He voiced many reservations. It was synthetic. There were too many unknowns. But his main objection to planting a biotech potato was simply that it's not what my customers want. I asked Heath about the new leaf potato. He had no doubt that resistance would come. Face it, he said, the bugs are always going to be smarter than we are. And he felt it was unjust that Monsanto was profiting from the ruin of a public good such as BT. None of this particularly surprised me. What did was the fact that Heath himself had resorted to spraying BT on his potatoes only once or twice in the last 10 years. I had assumed that organic farmers used BT and the other approved pesticides in much the same way conventional farmers use theirs. But as Mike Heath showed me around his farm, I began to understand that organic farming was a lot more complicated than simply substituting good inputs for bad. A whole different metaphor seemed to be involved. Instead of buying many inputs at all, Heath relies on a long and complex crop rotation to avoid a buildup of crop-specific pests. He's found, for instance, that planting wheat in a field prior to potatoes confuses the potato beetles when they emerge from their larval stage. He also plants strips of flowering plants on the margins of his potato fields, peas or alfalfa usually, to attract the beneficial insects that dine on beetle larvae and aphids. If there aren't enough beneficial insects around to do the job, he'll introduce ladybugs. Heath also grows a dozen different varieties of potatoes, on the theory that biodiversity in a field, as in the wild, is the best defense against nature's inevitable surprises. A bad year with one variety will likely be offset by a good year with the others. He doesn't, in other words, ever bet the farm on a single crop. By way of driving home a point, Heath dug some of his Yukon Golds for me to take home. I can eat any potato in this field right now. Most farmers can't eat their spuds out of the field. I decided not to mention my lunch. For fertilizers, Heath relies on green manures, growing cover crops and plowing them under, cow manure from a local dairy, and the occasional spraying of liquefied seaweed. The result was a soil that looked completely different from the other Magic Valley soils I'd fingered that day. Instead of the uniform grayish powder I'd assumed was normal for the area, Heath's soil was dark brown and crumbly. The difference, I understood, was that this soil was alive. Much more than an inert mechanism for conducting water and chemicals to the crop's roots, it actually contributed nutrients of its own making to the plants. The biology, chemistry, and physics of this process, which goes by the name fertility, is not at all well understood. Soil truly is a wilderness, yet this ignorance doesn't prevent organic farmers and gardeners from nurturing it. Heath's crops looked different, too. More compact plants. Chemical fertilizers tend to make plants leafier. The occasional weed and loads of insects flitting around. Here were the very opposite of clean fields, and frankly, their weedy hedgerows and overall patchiness made them much less pretty to look at. To the eye, at least, the order of these fields seemed much softer and less complete, with a great deal of disorder percolating at the margins. Of course, what the eye failed to see was a more complex, less human order. The order, that is, of an ecosystem. One that is not so much imposed by the farmer as it is nourished and tweaked by him. It is the very complexity of such fields, the sheer diversity of species in both space and time, that makes them productive year after year without many inputs. The system provides for most of its needs. On the drive back to Boise, I thought about why Mike Heath's farm remains the exception, both in Idaho and elsewhere. Here was a genuinely new paradigm, a biological paradigm, and it seemed to work. Heath spends a fraction as much on inputs as Danny Forsythe or Steve Young, yet he was digging between 300 and 400 bags per acre, just as many as Forsythe and only slightly fewer than Young. But while organic agriculture is gaining ground, few of the mainstream farmers I met considered it a realistic alternative to the way we presently grow our food. They may be right. In a dozen different ways, a farm like Mike Heath's simply can't be reconciled to the logic of a corporate food chain. For one thing, Heath's type of agriculture doesn't leave much room for the Monsantos of this world. Organic farmers buy remarkably little. Some seed,